Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Today we have for you a brand new episode just come out from under the 60-day embargo period during which our participating newspapers have exclusive rights. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on January 1st of 2023 under the headline Land Fraud Swindlers Plundered Oregon But Good. Here we go. On the morning of December 7th, 1904, Stephen A. D. Pewter had just arrived at the office of U.S. Marshal Jack Matthews. He was expecting some friends to come by and bail him out of jail. Pewter had just been convicted of masterminding a plan to swindle the U.S. government out of thousands of acres of prime timberlands. He had not yet been sentenced. Like all convicts, he had the option of either staying in jail until his sentencing or posting bail. In his case, bail was set at $4,000. He figured his friends, rather unindicted co-conspirators, would drop by shortly to help him raise the funds. He thought wrong. No one came. It was starting to dawn on Pewter that no one was going to come. To be sure about it, he called his brother and asked him to pay a few social calls on his friends and former business associates. The brother, as Pewter may have expected, soon reported back. None of the old cronies wanted to have anything to do with him anymore. Over the next few days, after he'd come up with his bail by borrowing it from family members, Pewter learned more details about why they were all so reticent. There was, as he'd well known, a new investigator in town from Washington, D.C., sent by the new Theodore Roosevelt administration and tasked with putting a stop to the rampant land frauds that had been going on for decades all across Oregon and the West. This new sheriff, Francis Haney, had started his campaign by going after Pewter, who was the most successful, prominent, and notorious of the crooked land agents. Now Pewter, the land fraud king, had been convicted along with several of his associates and lower-level financial backers, and the land fraudsters who had not yet been caught in Haney's dragnet were very much hoping that the government's thirst would be slaked by this high-profile win and that Haney would move on and let them continue pillaging the public domain as before. In other words, he was to be sacrificed to appease the gods in Washington, D.C. He was, to use an analogy way before its time, to be thrown under the bus, branded a bad apple, and socially disowned in order to protect the bigger fish involved and enable them to keep the good times rolling. And how much bigger were those bigger fish? Well, several of them were out-of-state millionaires. Of course, a millionaire in 1905 was pretty much comparable to a multi-billionaire today. Two of them were members of the U.S. House of Representatives, and one of them was United States Senator John H. Mitchell, whose name actually was not John H. Mitchell, but that's another story. Well, Pewter was good and angry about this situation by the time he made it out of jail, and he decided he was going to give his old friends a good scare for their pains at the very least. But although he doesn't say specifically, it looks as if Pewter didn't actually decide to go into full-on vengeance mode until Mitchell started regularly using him as a whipping boy in press conferences about land frauds. This was stupendously galling to Pewter, because at one point a few years earlier, he had actually paid Mitchell a $2,000 bribe to lean on the Lands Department to approve some fraudulent applications. "Had Senator Mitchell held his peace, his name should never have been mentioned by me," Pewter raged to a former business partner afterward. "But since he has seen fit to denounce me publicly through the columns of the daily press, discountenancing me in most scathing terms, I see no reason why I should protect him further." The business that Pewter had made his career in was one that had been going on in Oregon since the very dawn of Oregon statehood. By the time Roosevelt's administration decided to put a stop to it, the wealthy and well-connected had been stealing land from the state and federal governments for four decades. Around the time the state was admitted to the Union, legally almost all of it belonged to the federal government. This it was busily handing out to homesteaders who could file claims on big chunks of it and prove it up by building cabins and raising crops and claim title to it for just a nominal filing fee. The system worked pretty well for the parts of the state that were suitable for small farms, the Willamette Valley mostly, but it left big portions of the state out. Timberlands especially, as well as most of the drier portions of eastern Oregon, would not support a homesteader. So with an eye toward getting marginally farmable land and timberlands into productive use, the government created several new programs that were less rigorous. It also empowered the new state of Oregon to claim the state's swamp lands to be reclaimed for agriculture. It was the Swamp Lands Grant that gave Oregon its first real experience of wholesale land fraud. Maybe that was inevitable, since the whole idea of the grant was based on fantasy. The river bottomlands in the Mississippi Valley had included vast acres of malarial swamps, which could fairly easily be reclaimed by building dikes and levees and draining them, but doing that was very expensive. The feds had found it convenient to have the states take that on. They would take the swamp, reclaim it, and sell the resulting farmland to help the state pay its bills and put the land into productive use. Oregon had very little of that kind of swampland, but in 1870, the state legislature suddenly realized that if they redefined swamp to include bits of land that flooded once or twice in the spring, they could gin up a claim on vast amounts of the land in the state, which they could then hand over to their friends for super cheap. So here's how the swindle worked. A wealthy landowner, a sheep rancher, say, cultivated a state land agent and bribed or otherwise induced him to proclaim the banks and stream beds of every river, lake, or pond in the area he coveted as swampland. The landowner would then pay 20 cents per acre to reserve the property. After successfully reclaiming it, he would then be allowed to buy it outright for an additional 80 cents an acre. So the landowner would take charge of the seasonally flooded swampland, wait 6 months for the dry season, proclaim it reclaimed, and purchase it. In the case of our sheep rancher, this worked doubly well because by snapping up all the land with water running on it, he left nothing behind but dry pasture. He could be pretty confident that no sodbusters would be able to successfully claim any of it under the Homestead Act, so he'd get to graze all his sheep on it for free. But, you might object, with the state claiming huge swaths of swampland that wasn't really swampland, almost sight unseen, wasn't there a risk that the state would claim land that someone had already claimed? Yes, as a matter of fact, there was, and that happened a lot. In fact, it was one of the preferred outcomes of the scammers, because after the state had sold you someone else's land, it would have to give you another piece of state property in lieu of the one you'd contracted for. And you got to pick which piece of lieu land you got. You could go shopping, like a free upgrade to first class on a commercial flight. There's another anachronistic analogy. There were several other ways the state and federal governments could be hustled out of prime lands as well. The state wasn't fully surveyed yet. The policy of the state and federal governments was to honor the claims of legitimate homesteaders, even if their claims turned out to be in places that were set aside for other things, like local schools, land-grant universities, government buildings, that sort of stuff. The government would then give those homesteaders their pick of government-owned lands, lieu lands, first-class flight upgrades, in exchange. So people like Stephen Pewter would hurry out to remote mountainous sections that were about to be surveyed, stake virtually worthless claims, and exchange them for valuable timberlands after the survey. But probably the most common scam, and the one that Pewter was especially adept at, was the dummy entryman swindle. In this, after a new timber country township was surveyed, Pewter would hire random sailors and North End layabouts to go down to the land office and file land claims on it, with Pewter paying their filing fees. These dummies would go to the land office, perjure themselves by swearing that they had inspected their claims and intended to prove them up, and then basically sign them over to Pewter. Pewter would bribe a land office clerk to look the other way and allow the transaction, and then he would then lump together enough of these claims to make a decent-sized timber patch and sell them to an out-of-state timber baron. This kind of thing went on for decades. So, how did it all end? Well, first of all, the state's prime real estate started getting more and more scarce. At the same time, railroads and other organizations that had been given federal land grants were having trouble redeeming them because people like Pewter were snapping them up fraudulently. For the most part, the people participating in this swindle didn't really think of it as a big deal. Scarcity wasn't an issue. There was a seemingly endless supply of land. Everybody was making money, and everyone in the fraudulent marketplace was happy playing their part. The timber barons were getting prime timberlands for cheap, the land office clerks were getting a nice sideline income, the timber brokers like Pewter were greasing the wheels of commerce and getting well paid for it, and the land they were stealing was unsuitable for homesteaders anyway. So what if there were some weird, unreasonable requirements about residency and improvements and big operators not being allowed to buy land in bulk? Those requirements were for farmland, not timber. Who, they would have asked, who were they hurting? And, in the early years at least, most Oregonians agreed with that. But, by the turn of the century, that had changed. Happily ensconced in their little bubble of like-minded businessmen and politicians, the land thieves had gotten to be a bit out of touch with how their activities were playing with the public. As the new century dawned, the old greed-is-good ethos of the Gilded Age was wearing very thin. Members of the public, watching fat cats from out of state or even out of country take advantage of the situation to build vast absentee empires, they were starting to notice and resent. That was the biggest change that led to the end of the land fraud era, a change in the attitude of regular Americans. The beginning of the end for the land fraudsters came in about 1902, when a random citizen, a Catholic priest actually, wrote a letter to Interior Secretary Ethan Hitchcock alerting him to a series of land frauds in the Tillamook area. Complaints like this may have come in before. If they did, they were promptly shoved under a rug. But the Roosevelt administration was far more serious about things like land fraud than previous ones had been. Hitchcock took the report very seriously and sent Secret Service investigators, including the legendary William J. Burns, after whom the Burns Detective Agency was named, to investigate. The result was some very highly placed heads started rolling at the General Land Office. Pewter and his associates soon found familiar faces at the land office had disappeared, and their replacements were turning out to be a lot harder to bribe. After Investigator Haney flipped Pewter, things moved fairly quickly. Pewter's $2,000 bribe to Senator Mitchell had been in cash, so it was untraceable, but another land agent, Frederick Cribbs, paid his bribes with checks, which Mitchell had been imprudent enough to accept and deposit. Haney then went after Congressman John Williamson, who had apparently worked the system from within to acquire several thousands of acres for grazing land for his sheep ranch near Prineville, and also Congressman Binger Herman, the former commissioner of the General Land Office. Dozens of other operators, land agents like Pewter, as well as several of their wealthy out-of-state customers, were also tried. Many were convicted. Mitchell and Williamson were among them. Both appealed immediately. Williamson's conviction was overturned on appeal, and Mitchell's was dropped after he died from a dental abscess before his case could be heard. Herman's trial ended with a hung jury. So, no real high-profile characters spent significant jail time for the land fraud scandals. But the government had made its point, and after these trials, the days of easy land grabbing were over in Oregon. Unfortunately, by that point, most of the good land had been scooped up anyway. Key sources in this story have included works by Oliver Tatum, F.G. Young, and S.A.D. Pewter. Well, that is our show for today, and thanks again for listening. I do hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. By the way, most of us Oregon history buffs are also pretty interested in Washington history. There's a lot of really fascinating history north of the Columbia, and several times I've wished that someone would start an Offbeat Washington History or something like it. Well, somebody finally did. If you like this podcast, I think that you'll like John C.'s podcast, the History of the Evergreen State podcast. Right now, I'm desperately behind on my podcasts, but as I'm recording this, I'm just tucking into his episode about the Freeland Colony, a communist collective on Whidbey Island, and looking forward to the article on Lopez Island in the San Juans. Back in the mid-aughts, I took a job as editor of the island Sounder up in Orcas Island and got to know Lopez pretty well. That was pre-Offbeat Oregon. If I'd kept the job, I might never have started this podcast. If you're curious, I left at the end of the summer. Island life isn't for everyone. It made my wife miserable. Anyway, History of the Evergreen State podcast with John C. This is not a promotion. John has no idea I'm talking him up here. I'm just sharing this with you because I'm really enjoying his show, and I bet you will too. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatorgan.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Organ History episodes come around once per weekday, usually around 6 a.m. So it won't be long before the next episode is on your device and ready for you to queue up and listen to. And until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.